The Slate Culture Gabfest is brought to you by Harry's, the shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door. Visit harrys.com for $5 off your first purchase with the promo code CULTURE. And by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, we'll give you your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit braintreepayments.com/culture. And by the American Heart Association, which is urging lawmakers to save physical education. The average school gets just $764 every year for physical education. Go to heart.org/letthemplay to learn more and to take action.
Vanity Fair's Little Gold Men podcast brings you the latest updates from the campaign trail. The Oscar campaign, that is. Will the voters choose the establishment favorite?
It's Spielberg and it's Disney. You know, it goes down easy enough.
An upstart outsider with a compelling story.
There's a chance you show it and the audience just goes, I do not accept Jason Segel as David Foster Wallace.
Or has the eventual winner not even entered the race yet?
And we were all sitting here this year waiting on these three December movies that no one has seen.
Subscribe to Little Gold Men from Vanity Fair and Panoply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Radio Edition. It's Wednesday, November 4th, 2015. On today's show, Elvis Costello has gone from grotty new wave rebel to omnivorous dean of the pop songbook. Along the way, he has made some of the most enduring songs and albums in the pop era. Now he has a memoir. We discuss unfaithful music and disappearing ink with Slate's music critic Carl Wilson. And then Hotline Bling, the new music video from Drake, has gone full viral. We discuss the state of Drake with Slate's own Leon Neyfakh. And finally, Adele has died and gone to pre-order heaven, or so it seems, with her new teaser single, Hello. Joining me today is Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
And I should say that Julia Turner, unfortunately, is feeling unwell, and she's unable to join us today. So we've gone with three of the voices who write about music for Slate as fill-ins, and we are doing a all-music show. We don't typically do themed shows, do we?
Yeah, this was sort of one of those things that was born from necessity, but I think it's kind of a fun idea because there are some good musical things happening this week.
A happy shambles hopefully will ensue. All right. Well, Dana, before we start, we got to hear about Slate Plus, of course, and we have some other business as well.
Yes. This week on Slate Plus, we're going to talk, extending our music theme, about embarrassing workout songs and the music that we put on to pump ourselves up for exercise with our guest, Chris Malanfi. And the only other piece of business we have to talk about is our upcoming Slate live show, the Superfest, the big show that we're doing on November 16th at Town Hall in Manhattan with the Political Gabfest folks, with the Hang Up and Listen guys, and with Slate's own Dan Coyce from Mom and Dad Are Fighting as host. It's going to be a really fun show. So there are still some tickets available for that. You can go to slate.com/live to get your ticket. And as a special thank you to our Slate Plus members, I wanted to mention that every show at the Superfest, us, the Political Gabfest, and Hang Up and Listen, will be raffling off a basket of show-related swag. So that might be movies that I've endorsed on the show, books that you've talked about. I don't know what the heck is going to be in the other people's baskets, but they've been selected sort of for the taste of each podcaster, and there's a raffle. So if you're a Slate Plus member, the easiest way to enter this is to sign up before you go to the show, because it's going to be crazy once you get there. And to do that, you would email superfestraffle@gmail.com with your name. And if you're not a member, you can sign up to be at slate.com/plus. When you do so, of course, you'll also get ad-free versions of all our podcasts and special bonus segments for Slate Plus members. So that's it, Steve. Back to the show.
Thanks, Dana. All right, digging in. Elvis Costello is the cheeky nom de chanson of the British singer-songwriter Declan McManus, who started out in the 70s as a pub rocker, then made his early name as an angry young man. But there was never any hiding his deep musical roots in jazz, soul, music hall, folk. His first five or so albums, in my estimation, have only one rival in the pop canon for out-of-the-gate genius, and that would be Bob Dylan's first five or so records. He's gone on to be a living songbook of his own material, but also an encyclopedia of musical styles, popular and otherwise. And all through his work, he displays a commanding grasp of melody and lyric, and through these, he sends his own peculiar shivers of irony. I love Elvis Costello. I am so excited to be talking about them, but double it, because I'm doubly excited to be talking about it with Carl Wilson, Slate's music critic. Carl, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Carl, the occasion for this is the new memoir, Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. You have a piece forthcoming for Slate about it. We haven't had a chance to read your piece, but you've read the memoir. It weighs in at 674 pages. That is quite a doorstop. Where do you want to begin with it?
That is a good question. I mean, the book is really, it's both fascinating and sort of compelling in the way that Costello's entire manner is. You know, he's a great sort of raconteur and wit, and all of these things are very present in the book. And at the same time, it's also this kind of formless, rambling thing. It's a completely structureless memoir in a lot of ways. It's really lively in the moments where it hits sort of the electric moments of his life, but it doesn't follow in chronological order. A lot of it seems to be sort of almost free associated. You know, he starts, when he hits a point when he starts talking about his sort of first childhood encounter with the Beatles, and then it sort of drifts to the first time he met Paul McCartney, and then the next time he met Paul McCartney, and there's all of these kinds of things that go on. So it's kind of a frustrating book, but really entertaining on that level. But it also is really revealing in a lot of ways. I think that the central thing for me that it really altered about my perception of him is I knew long ago and beforehand that he came from a musical family and that his father was a musician of some kind. But to me, that was kind of sort of a vague fact about him. But like, his father was actually like a famous full-time singer.
And a band leader, right?
A real professional, like, dance band singer. And his grandfather as well was a professional musician. So he actually, like, comes from this long line of real working musicians. And in some ways, the way that he fleshes that out over the course of the book really altered my perception of Costello, particularly that sort of vision of the young Elvis Costello, that sort of whole sort of punk rock inflected angry young man thing. When you start to give that, it's just like, oh, but you're just in the family business. You're really just doing something. You're out there making a living in a way that really puts him in context in a way that really changes it. And then of course there's also sort of a personal level where his father was also a working musician and a philanderer and somebody who left his wife and a hard drinking guy and all. And so Costello also inherits a lot of those flaws along with the sort of talent.
Mm-hmm. I think we should hear a little Elvis before we go much further. Why don't we just listen to the very first cut from the very first album, Welcome to the Working Week.
Now that your picture's in a paper being rhythmically admired and you can't have any one that you have ever desired, all you gotta tell me now is why, welcome to the working week. Oh, I know it don't thrill you, I hope it don't kill you. Welcome to the working week. You gotta do it till you're through it, so you better get to it.
Carl, now that you've said that Elvis Costello talks a lot about his father and his relationship with his father in this memoir, I am definitely going to read it, even if it is 674 pages long, because I love when he talks about his father. That show Spectacle that he used to host on Ovation, I don't know if you ever saw that show. It was this great hour-long format show where he would have on a musician or a songwriter that he admired, and they would play each other's songs, play other people's songs, talk about music. It was kind of rambling like the book is and structureless, but it was wonderful. And one of the things I used to love on that show was when he would tell any kind of anecdote about his childhood and Ross McManus, his father. So I'm definitely going to read it just for that.
Yeah, that Spectacle is sort of one of the great miracles of Elvis Costello's career in a lot of ways, because, you know, who would have thought back in the days where he was scandalizing Saturday Night Live by breaking into radio when he wasn't supposed to play it, that he would like later be this kind of genial talk show host.
Carl, you referenced that famous appearance on Saturday Night Live very early on in his career. He goes on, he's told that he shouldn't play the song Radio Radio because it is sort of about biting the hand of big radio.
Calling Mr. Oswald with the swastika tattoo, there is a vacancy wage.
He gets two bars into, I think, less than zero. He stops the band, says,
I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, there's no reason to do this song here.
And he kicks into Radio Radio and does this scorching version of it, after which I think he's banned from the show for quite a while. Anyway, it's funny. He did start out as someone who looked and sounded the part of a punk or a post-punk or kind of a new wave, not especially appealing to look at, enraged, biting persona. How much of that was really him in a way, and how much of that was just a put on because he was looking for a crack to crawl through into the music business?
Yeah, I think mostly the latter. You know, when he's quite dismissive of punk in the book on the level particularly that he disdains the fantasy that punk entertained, that all previous music needed to be dismissed, and this idea that there was sort of a year zero in 1977 and that everything before it was dismissed. At one point, kind of crucially in the book, he says, you know, that music started to get better again in the early 80s when that persona was dropped and people like The Clash started raiding their record collection for ideas. And the thing that, you know, it really makes you aware of reading the book is that, like, Costello even more, you know, I think one of the things that we always underestimate about punk is that it's not really sort of the Gen X phenomenon that we think of it as sometimes. It's really like the last wave of baby boomers, right? And really in tension with 60s culture, which those people lived through. And Costello was just a little bit older than the main bulk of the punks. And so he really, what, like, the first part of the book, you know, you're watching him go to, like, Grateful Dead and Band and Crosby, Stills, and Nash concerts as, like, a late teenager. Like, and by the time that he emerged as a public figure, he was married with a child. You know, he was only in his early 20s, but he was still just a little bit older and a little bit more middle class and a little more settled. And I think because of that family music business background, a little bit more savvy on some levels than most of the supposed punk generation was. And so there's definitely, like, a game that he's playing where, you know, he started off sort of covering, you know, Paul Simon songs in folk clubs and then sort of turns around and rides this kind of punk new wave thing with a certain amount of skepticism and also a certain amount of savvy.
And also, I would add a huge degree more musicianship and knowledge of musical culture than the punks brought to their music. That's why they sounded the way they sounded, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a point, one of my favorite sentences in the whole book is when he just says, the Attractions played rings around everyone else, and I just had to stand in the middle and sing. You know, and all of those musicians mostly were found through, like, a want ad. But you think, oh, right, but when everybody came into an audition, your standards were more exacting and the people you were looking for were more specific than what everybody else who was throwing a band together in that day was like.
Mm-hmm. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about, I mean, so those first 4, 5, 6 albums are just, they're almost perfect all the way through, but he's been around for decades now and he's made a lot of different kinds of music. He loves to collaborate with his heroes, George Jones and
Burt Bacharach.
All through the night you telephoned, I saw the light blinking red beside the cradle. But you don't know how far I've come. Now I must live with the lie that I made.
Do you think in a way he was almost too gifted and prolific in a way, that it's such a huge discography now, it's hard to locate oneself in it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's one of the dilemmas of Costello's career is that, you know, it's absolutely true. I think that for those first 10 years, he could barely put a foot wrong, and he was so prolific and had a particular panache that is unique in some ways. And then after that, you know, everybody can sort of debate where the high points are.
Can I just stand up and say, though, I think that Burt Bacharach album is a masterpiece, and it took me a while to start feeling that way about it, but I think it's one of his best albums, although it is one of these later albums. It's a collaboration and is experimenting with different styles, and I completely respect that he never stood still.
Absolutely, and those collaborative moments are usually the most interesting, I think. But left to his own devices, he kind of ratchets between trying stuff he hasn't tried before and then, you know, although a lot of the time in the book he sort of denounces and says that he's not compelled by nostalgia, I think there's always that questing a little bit for that early magic, and critics definitely you know, collaborate in that problem. There's all, you know, he gets, there's the formula of, oh, his best album since XXX, and that happens over and over again in his work, but it's always kind of a almost a aspirational thing to declare his latest work. It's never without inspiration, but it's always never quite capturing that sort of quicksilver that he had at one point.
Mm. All right, but listen, before we go, let's each name a cut that we especially loved by the truly great Elvis Costello. Carl, let's start with you.
There's so many, you know, I mean, the song that comes to mind the most for me always is his song about Margaret Thatcher, Tramp the Dirt Down.
Well, I hope I don't die too soon. I prayed a lot, my soul to say, yes, I'll be a good boy. I'm trying so hard to behave, because there's one thing I know, I'd like to live long enough to savor. That's when
Dana, what do you got?
Oh, God, that's a really tough choice. I think we had a segment before where we talked about, you and Julie and I talked about the best live music show we'd ever seen. And my show was two back-to-back shows by Elvis Costello and the Attractions during the Blood and Chocolate tour. It was in Paris that I saw him. And it was just really unforgettable. So good that I went back another night. That was why I saw him two nights in a row. And then the second night he played an all-acoustic set and it was fantastic. Anyway, so anything from Blood and Chocolate is a great favorite of mine, maybe because of that period and that album. I guess I would say maybe my favorite song and the one that I still listen to the most from Blood and Chocolate would be Blue Chair, which is just such a perfect pop song and also just a wonderful kind of cry of romantic anguish. Also, of course, the whole album Imperial Bedroom, you can't really pick a song because it's a kind of concept album where all the songs link together into one big sound. But all of Imperial Bedroom is my favorite album.
You know, it's funny. When I was 17 or 18 years old, maybe I'd just been kicked out of high school. I was painfully in love with this young woman who went there and had not been able to see her for many months because I was exiled. And I went and visited her. She had this sort of profligate father with a half-completed beach house on the New Hampshire shore, and I went to visit her there. And all I remember from that weekend is playing cards with her endlessly while Imperial Bedroom played on loop. I hadn't heard the album yet, and she knew all the lyrics already, and so she was singing along to the entire album.
History repeats, the old conceits, the clip replies, the same defeats. Keep your finger on the button issues with crocodile tears and a bucket full of tissues. Just the oilers slip and wind the world of the nervous tick in a very fashionable harbor.
That record just absolutely corkscrewed its way, like, bewitchingly to my heart. And I've never known whether it's as toweringly great as I think it is, because I can't extricate it from that experience. But
it is. It is that great.
It is. For my song, I'm a little toss away. About a toss away on the Get Happy record called Motel Matches, which is just little and short and perfect and a perfect gem.
Somewhere in a distance, I can hear blue shot sand. This is my conviction.
All right, Carl, it's always so great to have you on the show. A complete pleasure. Carl Wilson, thanks so much for coming on to talk about Elvis Costello.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, and people, please come and tell us what your favorite Elvis Costello song is if you have one at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our sponsor, Dana Stevens. What do we have?
Stephen, this week we are sponsored by one of your favorite of our sponsors, Harry's Razors.
Oh, yeah, Harry's. Yeah, bring it on.
So this week we wanted to mention that Harry's is an official partner of the Movember Foundation and will be donating money and helping to raise awareness for men's health this month. You know about Movember, Steve, right?
Remind me.
Movember is the reason that many people that you see in the streets, men, are probably going around with strange, shaggy facial hair of different kinds, because Movember is a month where men grow mustaches and other facial hair forms to raise awareness for men's health issues. I feel like as a Harry's user, you should participate yourself. You should grow some sort of a soul patch or a goatee or a some firemen's, what do they call them? You know, mutton chop sideburns
mutton
or something.
Mutton chop. The truth is, I always have oddly positioned, unsightly facial hair growths on my face anyway, so I feel as though I've been striking a blow for men's health unconsciously for decades now, but I can do it now semi-consciously. But then, after you've grown this bizarre devil's patch, what are you going to shave it off with?
Well, the fact is that to even grow it, right, you've got to shape it. You've got to shape it with some sort of a hair removal device, or else you're not celebrating Movember. You're just turning back into a caveman.
All right. And if you're going to do that, do you want to give your tithe to the oligopoly? No, you don't want to do that. What you want to do is buy your razor from someone who has bypassed the egregious, the totally superfluous middleman. The thieving middleman who drives up the prices of tiny little commodity item razors to preposterous heights. That's ridiculous. In the age of the internet, you should be buying your razors directly from Harry's, which I do. I did completely independently of the sponsorship, by the way, and have been nothing but totally happy. As a person who somewhat dreads shaving, the kind of, you know, like kind of Christmas gift aspect of this neat little box coming in the mail at a reasonable price and giving me the tools to be clean shaven has been a total pleasure.
Totally with you on that, Steve. So let's just tell listeners about the deal that Harry's is offering to Slate Culture Gabfest listeners right now. For just $10, if you use our Culture Gabfest code CULTURE, you can get a razor handle, 3-blade cartridges, and your choice of shaving cream or foaming shave gel, and the shipping is all free. So go to harrys.com right now. You can get $5 off your first order, again with the promo code CULTURE. That's harrys.com, and enter the code CULTURE to start celebrating Movember and shaping your facial hair. All right, Steve, back to the show.
Thanks, Dana. All right, moving on. Drake is the nice guy rapper from Canada. He has a new music video, Hotline Bling, that only moments after it was dropped got picked up and virally. In fact, I should say it didn't even really go viral. It went full meme. Leon Nafak is the criminal justice reporter for Slate. He wrote a great article about Drake called Peak Drake for Fader Magazine. He joins us to talk about Drake and the new music video. Leon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back, I should say. I want to plug your book, The Next Level. We talked about that before. Great book.
Thank you.
And a great success. Congrats. All right. Walk me through this a little bit. Drake means close to nothing to me, but tell us what he means to you and what this latest data point in the career of Drake means.
You know, I am an unabashed fan of his. I look forward to every little thing he does. And I love this video. I think it's really funny. And I love the song. I think it's one of his best songs. It's one of his most catchy songs. And it was really thrilling to see it go from being a sort of throwaway that he played on his Apple Music radio show to being almost the number one song in the country.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, why don't we listen to Hotline Bling?
Yeah. You used to call me on my cell phone night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need my love. And I know when that hotline bling, that can only mean one thing. I know when that hotline bling, that can only mean one thing.
So to describe the video that goes along with this song, which I think is a really key part to why it's hit so huge, right, is the kind of the disjunction between the visuals and the song and his dancing in the video. So to describe the video, it begins with what seems to be a call center, maybe for a sex hotline, right, with a bunch of bodacious ladies in matching pink T-shirts and blue jeans answering the phone with these suggestive phrases. And then for the rest of the video, we proceed to enter what seems to be a James Turrell light installation, right, the artist who works with big spaces filled with colored light. I mean, the spaces that have been created for this video by a guy who goes by the name Director X look almost exactly like a James Turrell installation. And by the way, it's not us noticing that this looks like a James Turrell light installation. The director and Drake have both acknowledged that influence, and Turrell himself has come out with a really funny press release statement about it. Steve, do you have that?
Yeah. Turrell has said, "While I am truly flattered to learn that Drake fucks with me, I nevertheless wish to make clear that neither I nor any of my woes was involved in any way in the making of the Hotline Bling video. I love it. No conceptual artists were hurt in the making of this video."
And so in these light-flooded white boxes that seem to be shifting color from shot to shot, Drake and the bodacious ladies appear in alternate shots dancing. The ladies, very well. Drake, in his own fashion, that I think we should describe, because the Drake dance has been a big part of why Hotline Bling has hit so big. We should all describe it together, because it takes a village to describe.
I mean, let me put it this way. There's rarely been a music video in which I could recreate the dancing that takes place in it. And this may be that music video, right? I mean, it's kind of a lot of meandering, kind of walking around these light sets that you described, making fairly minimalist hand gestures, almost like he's playing a game of ping pong. I don't know. I can't even describe it. How would you describe it, Liam?
Well, I liked what the director said when they sort of asked, how did you arrive at the move for Drake? And he said, you can't choreograph that. That's just a man dancing. And there is something refreshing when every hip-hop video is filled with incredibly virtuosic dancing that makes you feel like any way that you move to the song would necessarily be just too dorky for words. To see somebody dancing, like, worse than your average kind of dad at prom or something.
Yeah, it is like Chaperone Dad. He's dancing like Chaperone Dad. And like Chaperone Dad, he didn't take his down jacket off.
I think it's been described as dad dancing, I think, in a couple of places. And I think dad dancing kind of implies that, like, the person doing it is, like, wrong to feel cool doing whatever he's doing. I think he does look cool. I think, you know, I'm not saying that he's some amazing dancer, but he you can tell he's having the time of his life, and you can tell that he's making it up as he goes along. And you can tell that he feels cool moving around this way. And I think it's really infectious. And I think people identify with that, and they can remember times when they've been at parties and they've been goofing off on the dance floor and sort of finding their rhythm. And I think that's what you see in this video.
Well, the disjunction, too, I think part of what makes it so comical is the disjunction between these really, artificial, deliberate, beautiful sets that are very artful, and then this dancing that really just does seem to be like a dude at a party. So there's a very comic element to this video, right? And the song itself is comic because Hotline Bling, as I understand the lyric, is all about him asking why his girl won't call him anymore.
Yeah,
While he sits around just being the neediest dweeb you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, I feel like I've always sort of interpreted the song as being about, like, an ex-girlfriend who he dated before he was famous, which is, like, a topic he returns to over and over again in his music. He's, like, constantly singing about girls that he had relationships with before he was Drake. He's, like, talked in interviews before about how he, like, is sad that they've moved on. They have these normal lives with, like, good boyfriends and husbands and possibly
filling
children.
Their passport with stamps, he says in the song, right?
Yeah.
They're traveling.
Yeah, I guess in this song he's, like, describing someone who's become, like, more of a party girl or whatever. And I think people have been turned off maybe by the tone he takes towards this person, because it sounds like he's saying, like, I liked you better when you were staying at home all the time. I don't know. I guess I've always heard the song as sort of not being sung to someone so much as, like, him just, like, having these thoughts privately. And he's just, at one point he says, I feel left out. I don't know. Doesn't strike me as evil so much as just, like, an honest expression of melancholy that I feel like anyone can identify with.
Mm-hmm.
Leon, can we get to the meme ability of this song? Because that, I think, is one of the main reasons we decided to talk about it. We've discussed Drake as a musician before, but the particular impact of this video has been that it's so infinitely memeable. And Drake and the director have both talked about how they knew that. They realized that as they were putting it together. And that, you know, these corny dance moves we're talking about were kind of ideal for a GIF. And, you know, that people have done all these great things like combine, you know, Kirk and Spock from the Star Trek movies with Drake dancing and create little narratives out of it.
He's really good at this. He's like, he's been doing this for years now, where he just, not necessarily with GIFs, but, you know, he comes up with little phrases like that people just want to use on social media as hashtags. He writes songs that are sort of, that revolve around words that everyone just wants to like take for themselves. And I think it's been a big like source of his power. This video certainly was, you know, created to be the source material for people making stuff out of it. There's these very long shots that I think probably make that pretty easy.
Also because he could be dancing to any song, since he's so arrhythmic, you can basically put it with anything and it goes.
Yeah.
So I think, unfortunately, we have to wrap up this segment, but I would send people, even if they're not particularly interested in Drake, to watch this video because it's lots of fun. And I was thinking maybe we should all name our favorite move. What is your single favorite dance move that Drake invents as he goes along in the Hotline Bling video?
There's one thing he does where he kind of puts his arms out to the sides and kind of jiggles his elbows and his head kind of bobs in between his arms. And it just reminds me of Tevye from Fiddler on the Roof when he's dancing to If I Were a Rich Man. I feel like, I bet Drake identifies with Tevye.
He could play a Tevye. He could
totally
pull off a Tevye.
I would put money on Drake being on Broadway within 20 years, but it would be pretty cool if he was in Fiddler on the Roof.
I can't pick out a favorite dance move, but I do think I have a description for how he dances. It's like he's playing ping pong with Schrodinger's cat.
Well, I think I'm going to go...
What can I say? I tried. I have nothing to say about Drake.
That's good. Schrodinger's cat is perfect. I'm going to have to go with the double Carly Rae Jepsen when he does a little phone pinky with each hand and kind of jiggles in between like he can't decide which hand to answer first. That move was described in this great Mashable post that breaks down the choreography into some basic moves as something like... I can't remember the name of that fruit right now, but it sounds really, really good.
I mean, I have to say between us, the Tevye, the double Carly Rae, and Schrodinger's cat is not bad. All right. Well, Leon, always a huge pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having
show.
Me.
Please come back soon.
Thank you.
All right. And also, we'll link to your article on the show page. It's called Peak Drake, and it was in Fader magazine. Thanks again, Leon.
Thanks.
All right. Now is the moment in our show where we talk about our other sponsor. Dana Stevens, what do we have?
Yes, indeed. Our second sponsor this week, Steve, is Braintree. Braintree makes mobile payments fast, easy, and seamless. With a few lines of code, your site is instantly ready to accept PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin, any form of payment. And if some other way to pay comes along, Braintree will support that too. To check out Braintree's mobile checkout experience for yourself, visit braintree-payments.com/culture. Okay, Stephen, back to the show.
Thanks, Dana. All right, moving on. Adele is the British singer-songwriter. Her album, 21, it was her second record, is the longest-running number one by a UK studio album in the United States. It broke record after record after record. She's now returned with the single Hello, with the accompanying video. We're joined by Chris Malamphy to talk about Adele and the state of the pop charts. He writes the Why Is This Song Number One column for Slate and is a chart analyst extraordinaire. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Chris, you're in the process right now of writing about this song because it's in the process of swallowing the globe whole. Tell us about it and Adele and why it's so huge.
I mean, it's huge because it is Adele, right? I mean, as you let in at the top, anything Adele released leading into her next album, which, by the way, is coming out in about 3 weeks, it's going to be called 25, anything she released would have been a massive hit, presumably. But the setup for Hello in particular has been just D-Day precise. I mean, they've really lined everything up. And as I'm pondering the song right now for my piece about it, what occurs to me is that it isn't just any old Adele song. It's kind of a meta Adele song. I mean, all of Adele's songs have been in some way about Adele. You may recall from her smash album 21, which dominated the charts in 2011 and 2012. That one of her biggest hits was called Someone Like You, which was about, an ex-lover. Indeed, the whole album was about, an ex of hers and was a sort of the Heartbreak album. This song, Hello, is a worthy sequel to that. I mean, it's about Adele. It's about her relationship to an ex yet again. And it's kind of about Adele's relationship to the general public. You might as well have titled the song Hello to My Global Public. I mean, you know, it may be the first song that she's done that isn't just about Adele. It's also kind of about itself. You know, she's almost implying, no, please do call it a comeback. I'm here. And you can really see it when you watch the video, which I know you guys have just watched for the first time, if I'm not mistaken. And the video is very much set up to sort of reintroduce Adele in grand fashion. And there's a moment about a minute into the video, which I have watched over and over again as I've been preparing for this piece, where you kind of haven't been seeing much of Adele's face. And then all of a sudden, about a minute in, you can actually see this still if you Google Adele right now and look at any of the many articles that are writing about her amazing chart feats. They all have frozen on this moment where Adele finally turns to the camera and looks dead on into the camera and basically is like, you know, peering into your soul. And that's kind of the moment when, you know, the first piano droplets of the song kick in and you know, the song begins its wounded journey. it's branding 101, and you know, they have branded this to the hilt.
Yeah, it begins its wounded journey to my minivan CD player, where it's going to be played nonstop for the next 6 months by my two daughters. All right, well, let's start our wounded journey by listening to the song. I mean, Dana, isn't she a little bit in danger of the spurned lover persona just taking over her image completely?
Yeah, that really struck me as is a strange choice for your very first appearance back on the market, you know, after this time off, having a baby, you know, settling down, and apparently in her actual life, getting over whatever heartbreak led to the album 21, and then popping back up to say, hey, I'm just calling so we can go over everything about the breakup. It makes me think of Drake in the Hotline Bling video we were discussing earlier, where she's sort of the pitiful left behind lover, you know, popping up again to say, like, wait, there's a few more things to analyze, you know, and there's a funny line that keeps, well, not meant to be funny, obviously, but a line that keeps recurring about, I've called you 1,000 times, but you never seem to be home. And of course, you just imagine the ex-lover just screening the calls.
Yeah.
It's Adele again, God damn it.
She's never heard of caller ID, apparently. Chris, you're saying in a way this is kind of meta, that it's actually quite aware of what it's doing, that she's worming her way back into our collective hearts by saying she's still Adele. Maybe there will be huge surprises on the record. She'll go in a completely different direction.
There needs to be an I Will Survive moment on this album, right? Have you heard the whole album yet, Chris, or it's not available to be heard?
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody's heard the whole album yet. It's been under lock and key. I mean, this album, in theory, was going to appear in time for the holiday season of 2014, and now here it is a year later, and they're finally deploying it. So the songs for this record have been in the works for quite some time. I mean, it's a little hard to overstate how anticipated 25, this Adele album, is for the record business as a whole. Frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if rival record labels were rooting for it. I mean, it is hard to overstate how out of character her performance this decade was just as a sales phenomenon. 21 in America sold 11.2 million copies. That number should blow your mind. Albums don't sell 11.2 million copies anymore. I mean, a hit album now is lucky to go platinum, which is a single million. And here's Adele, you know, and she was the long distance runner, by the way. That album was the number one album of both 2011 and 2012. It's the first album to be number one of two consecutive years since Thriller. It is not too grand to call it, at least on a sales level, the Thriller of this decade. It stands head and shoulders above everything else that's been released, including, Steve, your dreaded Taylor Swift. I mean, Taylor Swift is more front-loaded. She does, you know, 1.3 million in a week, and she, you know, sells and sells and sells, and she does very well. But her albums tend to finally peter out at about 5 or 6 million. The Adele album sold twice that. But to get back to the lyrics, I mean, yeah, I do see it as very much in her wheelhouse, very much of her brand. I mean, it's basically, you know, Adele, your queen of heartbreak, is back. Like, you know, not a day has gone by since 2012, the last time she released a single, and she's picking right up where she left off. I mean, if you focus on the lyric in miniature, it is, to your point, Dana, kind of a flip-flop of the theme of the 21 singles, insofar as if she's almost the party who has wronged someone, as opposed to the theme of all of the 21 singles was, I have been wronged. This is a, I'm so sorry for what I've done. I've read a couple of interviews with Adele where she claims that, you know, the song is both to a composite lover, but also kind of to her public, because she knows she's been gone a while. She hasn't released any material since Skyfall, the single from the James Bond movie, which came out in late 2012.
One of the best Bond songs ever, by the way.
Yeah, no, I really like that song too. But she hasn't put out anything since then. And so I very much see the lyric to this song as having it both ways. It's a twofer. It's both, you know, doing the queen of heartbreak thing kind of from the flip side, like, no, please pick up the phone. I want to talk to you. I'm so sorry that I left you behind. And at the same time saying to her public, hello, it's me. It's literally the first line of the song. Hello, it's me. You know, I was wondering if after all these years you'd like to meet to go over everything. It might as well be the detail of, you know, the rollout of her album. You know, it could be a marketing plan, for crying out loud.
Another thing that's remarkable about the video is that we see the lover, right? I don't think in any of the videos for 21 we ever saw the man that she has been pining for all these years. But he plays a large part in these flashbacks where you see him cooking her dinner and laughing with her and these sad memories that she's reaching back for, which to me was a little bit, I mean, I'm, in general, find this to be true about music videos, but it seems so flat and illustrative, like there he is. You know, it seemed like a little bit of a downer.
Yeah, no, it is remarkable. And actually the performance by the actor in the video, Tristan Wilds, who fans of The Wire may recognize from the fourth season of The Wire. He was one of the
boys.
Oh,
it's Michael, right. Yeah, he looks so different. It's Michael from The Wire.
Yeah, all grown up now. And it's really quite a remarkable performance, just an interesting casting in general. And you're right, it's kind of a new wrinkle. But, you know, again, I like the song, but at the same time, I can't help but look at this as branding 101. It's like taking what worked before, tweaking it just 45 degrees to the left, and saying, here you go, here's the new thing, same as the old thing, but a little bit different. I mean, that to me is what the song is all about.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems inevitable that the album is going to start there and then go in new directions. She's too savvy to have the rest of the record hit that same note. There's going to be, the next one's going to be a curveball. I'm sure of it.
There has to be a song about her baby, too, right? Nobody has a song about a baby and then doesn't come back in their comeback and write a song about their baby. And I want to hear that, because I really think Adele is she's one of the great heartstring tuggers. You know, I'm kind of teasing her in this segment because I don't actually love this song, but I do love Adele, and I love when she hits that exact note of longing and heartbreak.
Chris, before the end of the segment, I really want to ask you, at the height of her success with 21, she was derided as music for soccer moms. And there is a sense maybe she's selling a lot of records because she's selling records to people who aren't internet savvy. I mean, of course, her appeal is cross-generational. She couldn't be as big as she was if it weren't. But a lot of people who maybe don't principally get their music digitally are willing to go out and buy a CD for her. Is there something about the Adele persona, the Adele sound, and the Adele business model that's so profitable because it's uncool?
By contemporary standards, absolutely. I mean, what's remarkable about Adele, particularly for the modern music business, is how she's had it both ways. Like, first of all, there are stats that something like 80% of the sales of 21 were on plain old physical CD. So they, you know, it did very well digitally. It sold something like 2 million copies digitally, but there were 11 million copies sold of that thing, and the vast majority of them were sold on traditional, you know, plastic CD. So there's definite truth to that it is the record that's sold to people who don't buy records very often anymore. On the other hand, Adele had big old hits on the radio. I mean, a lot of the stuff that sells to folks in their 30s, 40s, 50s is stuff that isn't necessarily radio music. You know, think back to the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack, or, you know, any one of the so-called Starbucks favorites of the 2000s, which were, you know, sold to people who, you know, bought them with their latte. I mean, those were not records that were doing well on the radio. They were kind of album phenomena. The album that Adele is sometimes compared to, or the artist that she's sometimes compared to, is Norah Jones, who had a similar sales trajectory in the early 2000s. That album, Come Away With Me, similarly sold 10 million copies at a time when the record industry was already starting to tail off and records weren't really selling 10 million copies anymore. And then she came back in 2004 with an album called Feels Like Home that debuted to 1 million copies in its first week. Anticipation for Norah Jones's second album was off the charts ridiculous, much the way anticipation for this third album from Adele is off the charts ridiculous. But Norah Jones kind of petered out on that second album. It was very front-loaded. Everybody bought it the first, you know, month, and then it didn't really blanket the radio. She wasn't really a radio artist to begin with. Whereas Adele, I mean, in 2011, 2012, Rolling in the Deep was a number one hit on the Hot 100. Someone Like You was a number one hit on the Hot 100. Set Fire to the Rain, number one hit. Like, these songs were listened to by teenagers. They were listened to by people across the spectrum. So she has this very unique position right now. She's competing with the Taylor Swifts. She is quite literally competing with the Justin Biebers and the Drakes. I wrote a piece last week about how she basically blocked Drake from having a number one hit. And yet she also sells to soccer moms. She also sells to people who are not savvy about current culture. That's a pretty rare position. And, you know, with this song, I think they are protecting that position. They are, you know, reinvigorating the brand. And then, to Dana's point, hopefully on the album, there's going to be something different so that it's not, you know, all Adele, Queen of Heartbreak all the time.
Mm. Okay, well, Chris, will you stick around and endorse and do Slap Plus with us?
I would be happy to do Slap Plus.
Lovely. All right, well, the song is Hello. It's by Adele. It's everywhere. I'm sure you've experienced it. Well, we'd love to hear what you think about Adele at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, now is the moment in our show where we talk about our other sponsor. Dana Stevens, what do we have?
Stephen, the Slate Culture Gabfest is also sponsored this week by the American Heart Association, which is urging lawmakers to save physical education. We all know that physical education is a crucial part of being a kid. Physically fit children perform better academically, they exhibit better classroom behavior, and they have higher attendance rates. That's why the American Heart Association is urging Congress to save physical education. As lawmakers work to finalize the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, strong physical education policy should be a top priority. But some lawmakers want to do away with physical education altogether. You can learn more about the Heart Association's attempt to save physical education and take action yourself at heart.org/letthemplay. All right, Stephen, back to the show.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana Stevens. What do you have?
Well, since we talked with Carl Wilson about Elvis Costello and his relationship to his father, and I was talking about how much I love Elvis Costello dad stories, I wanted to throw you to a couple of places where you can hear some recent Elvis Costello dad stories. He's all over the place lately because of this memoir coming out. So you see him on every talk show. He's done something for Slate. And I think that people should go out and check those things out. For one thing, he talked to Slate's own Dan Coyce at the Sixth and I Synagogue in D.C. And you can watch that clip on Slate. He plays some music. He talks about his childhood and about his twin sons with Diana Krall, the singer, and it's a wonderfully personable interview. So we'll put a link to that on the show page. And also, he did a great, great appearance on the Stephen Colbert Show, the new Stephen Colbert Late Show, where he, again, sings and talks and tells some Ross McManus stories that just really, really take the cake. So if you want to hear some good Elvis Costello talking, go listen to him talk to Dan Coyce and Stephen Colbert. We'll put links on the show page.
Excellent. Chris, what do you got?
I want to talk about Carly Rae Jepsen. I am fascinated by this album that she put out now about 2 months ago, Emotion, or, you know, as it is spelled, Emotion, which is, I think, my favorite pop album of the year. And it's sort of remarkable because what's happened to Carly Rae Jepsen, she of, 2012 and Call Me Maybe fame, has become basically a cause celeb of critics more than of the radio. None of the singles from this album have done well at all. They tried multiple times to sort of connect with Top 40 radio, and the record is catchy as hell, and yet somehow this album hasn't generated the hits that really her prior album only had one hit, and it was, you know, the big one, Call Me Maybe. But I'm really enjoying this album. I'm playing it to death. There are tracks on it like Run Away With Me or Making the Most of the Night that are among the catchiest things I've heard all year. They, for all the world, sound like radio music, but they just aren't connecting in that way. And so I guess I'm endorsing the idea of listening to Carly Rae Jepsen at album length. It is a very, bright, shiny pop album, but also a very carefully produced, ornate pop album. And it's just got hook after hook. So anyway, for what it's worth, that's the album I'm playing the most these days.
Chris, it's too bad Julia's not in here today because we're always trying to get her to become an album person instead of the single person that she is. So maybe you could convert her by sort of taking the ultimate single artist, which is how I would think of someone like Carly Rae Jepsen, and listening to them at album length.
Yeah, no, the critics have all kind of chimed in that this is one that you can actually really enjoy at full length. So yeah, this would be the one for Julia. It's a gateway drug.
All right. Well, I'm going to go full Metcalf, and I'm going to endorse an interview in Eurozine magazine with the philosopher Jürgen Habermas.
Eurozine. I hear it hit my doorstep every month, Stephen.
It's the title of the interview is Critique and Communication Philosophy's Missions. You know, I mean, Habermas is, what can you say? I hate to say it, he's probably the last of a type, which is the great master thinker who in his person carries with him the tradition of the Enlightenment. I think that that existed in our culture for 300 years, or, you know, certainly back to Kant and probably a little bit before that. And I'm afraid it's probably going away with this person, and he's quite elderly now. And it's worth hearing him talk about the relationship of philosophy to the Enlightenment, to religion, to neoliberalism, and he does all three of those things in this interview. It's profoundly moving. I think Habermas is the great living European intellectual. I see no equivalent sequel possible. The culture just won't permit it. And then the other thing I want to endorse on a slightly lighter note is there's a great YouTube video of Elvis Costello doing the song Man Out of Time from Imperial Bedroom. It's the, for what it's worth, it's in Chicago on 5/15. 2011. And the reason to watch that one is a young woman gets up. He does it as a kind of a rocker, like it's a little more rollicking than the album version. It's just such a great song. And a woman from the audience gets up to his right and starts doing this just great, crazy, I think she's in a little black dress, but this just dance. Like she's, I don't know what, how she got up kind of half on stage to do it. And she's just grooving to the song. Like she's picked up on the rollick of this live version, and she just has to co-perform it with him. And about halfway through, he spies her, and she's quite attractive. And he has both the, like, ironic older man lecher look in his eye when he sees her, and the, am I about to get fucking offed in front of 11,000 screaming fans by this lunatic? And it just infuses the performance with this extra aura of sex and danger.
What's the song again? I'm going to look for that.
Man Out of Time.
Man Out of Time. Great.
One of the great cuts. That song, I think, kept me alive for all of 1982. But anyway, Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Chris, thank you so much for filling in. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest, and you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Ann Hepperman. Our intern is Lindsay Albrecht. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. The Culture Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster on itunes.com/panoply. Our Twitter feed, as always, is @SlateCultFest. Boom, boom. Boom. For Chris Malamphy and Carl Wilson and Leon Nafak and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you soon.
Didn't I tell you I could do it? I told everyone I could do it. Nobody didn't believe me, but now they can admit it. I am the greatest loving man that ever was, baby. I'm going to tell you something different.